Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening and welcome to the Veterans News Hour for February the 19th, 2018. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you? And tonight we have Brian Ellis as our guest. Brian was on our show last week. He's an Army veteran, served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's back with us to continue our conversation so he can tell us more about his post-military work in helping veterans deal with and overcome obstacles such as transitioning into from military to civilian life. But first, remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, gifts. Please call us during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, toll-free number 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. For those listeners who missed last week's excellent show, our guest tonight, Brian Ellis, is a member of the generation of Americans who heard the call to military service as a direct result of the terror attacks of September the 11th, 2001. Brian served in Iraq as a frontline infantryman during the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and after being injured in Iraq and then recovering from his injuries, he retrained to become a UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter crew chief and a newly formed medical evacuation unit. He then deployed to a forward operating base in northwest Afghanistan, where he flew over 50 medevac missions in his nine-month tour of duty. Brian returned home to the United States, and as he will tell you, had a difficult transition from war back to civilian life. He's our guest again tonight to share with you his experiences and his insights as a combat veteran. He devotes his work now to helping other veterans recover from post-traumatic stress disorder and make a successful transition to civilian life. So let's welcome Brian Ellis back to the Veterans News Hour. Good evening, Brian. How are you?
Good evening, Richard. Good evening, David. Thank you again for having me.
Yeah, well, we have a lot to discuss. So, Brian, why don't you tell us what was it like as you left active duty, you returned from your deployment in Afghanistan, your second combat tour, and then you returned to the civilian world. How did you do? How did you fare in that transition?
You know, from the very beginning, it was almost a tragedy, to be honest with you. At my first few days home was not what I expected at all. I had a lot of mishaps with vehicles and things of that nature. Things, you know, after they sit for a year, they tend not to want to work after a while. And there was other issues that went along with it, reintegrating back into my family, things of that nature. It was very difficult. Even the first week of being home, the power dynamic between my ex-wife and I was unbelievable. She was in control, and she really, her and my children developed a routine. And right when I got home, that routine was broken, and the whole house was unsettled. From what time I woke the kids up to go to school and how I was waking the kids up. I just got done doing a deployment in Afghanistan, an NCO. And, you know, and I really put a filter on, but, you know, as leaders and NCOs and military people come from this environment, you know, it's really hard to turn a switch. It's not like you're flipping a switch. So it was different. It was definitely an experience. The first week there was a huge learning curve. There was a lot of arguments. kids weren't really having it, even though they're happy I was home. Immediately after the transition back to family, though, like I initially said last week, I went right to the VA. I went to the VA to get care because I knew I needed some help, and that was an interesting experience. You know, when you go to the VA, I went to the post deployment clinic here in Tampa, and they give you a full medical exam. You do almost like a full physical examination, and then you do a mental health evaluation. When they did my mental health evaluation,
They concluded that I needed some psychiatric help because of what I just experienced. And then they personally walked me over to the Center for Post-Deployment Health and Education. And that's where I started my almost two-year process of being treated for PTSD and substance abuse.
How did you find that two-year period where you were getting involved with the VA, using their resources? How did you find that?
The system was relatively easy to navigate because of the way they have the post-deployment clinic set up. The only people they deal with are guys coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're really quick about getting in because they know they have a timeline that they have to work with, especially if it's mental health. I don't recall the timeline, but it's a very short timeline. So it was fairly quick. Now, when I got to the CPHE, it was a totally different experience. There was a lot of pros and cons about working with the VA staff. Unfortunately, literally my first interview, my first day with one of the psychologists at the CPHE was fairly inappropriate. We sat down for about 30 minutes and I explained who I am and what I've done and what my symptomology is and things of that nature. And he pretty much looked at me and said, "You're pretty effed up."
Wow.
So that's not what I expected at all. I'm pretty intuitive. I know who I am and I know myself very well. And I don't know if he was just trying to see if I was serious about being there. But he was an interesting character. He pushed back and he really challenged behaviors and actions, and things that you were doing. And, I almost left.
Can I ask you something there, Brian? Let me ask you about that.
Yes, of course.
Whenever he was very blunt about his assessment, did you take it more of this guy was just trying to have a shock effect with you, or was it perhaps that he was trying to acknowledge maybe something that he thought you had already concluded? Or how did you take that?
So I was extremely insulted.
I see.
I was very insulted at the beginning. Like I said, I pushed through it because, I had told my wife at the time that I was gonna seek help and I was gonna do everything I could to kind of rise above what I was going through. And I stuck with it. If it was a younger man, they would have probably left.
I see.
I think his bluntness and the way he was is, like I was saying before, I really think that he was trying to weed out the people that were just there trying to gain benefits. And that's a whole nother story. I mean, the VA's got a dual role. The VA not only provides medical attention and mental health care, but they provide benefits and disability ratings and things of that nature.
Right.
So it's a complex relationship when you're working with people at the VA, because you'll have some that are completely genuine and they're there to help, and they totally, the thought that you're there to obtain benefits is nowhere on their mind.
I see.
And they're there to help you. They're there to help you. Then there's other people that you deal with. They're very skeptical. Whether or not they were used at one point in time, or they caught something a lie, or whatever the situation may be. But they can be very inappropriate and very abrupt. I volunteered many, many hours at the VA. I was a work study at the VA, and I encountered quite a few employees like that. They almost forget that they're working in a medical field. It's a very interesting.
It seemed to matter, Brian, of the people that you just described that perhaps had a callous or a skeptical or cynical attitude towards a veteran. Did that seem to vary depending on whether those individuals themselves were veterans or not? Did it tend to be that they weren't veterans, or maybe they were veterans? And, because when I was in the service, everyone in the service is not alike in their background and their thought process. And And there are some in the service that really come from and continue reinforce the idea of, like, we have to suck up any problems, press on, and you know, that sort of a mindset. And so what how did you perceive it? Were these was the attitude you were seeing in the VA, was that kind of irregardless of whether those employees themselves were veterans?
It's irregardless. I've met and worked with civilians that were top-notch, great people. I would trust them to this day. You know, and then there's other people that matter of fact, the young man I'm talking about right now, he's no longer at the VA. The guy that did the initial interview with me, he's no longer at the VA.
I see.
And then there's other people that I worked with that are no longer at the VA, too, because they're abusing their authority as clinicians and things of that nature. But,
right.
You know, they kind of go back to where I was starting from. After that experience, I was a little apprehensive to continue, even though I did. When I met the psychologist that I was going to be working, there was two psychologists that I worked with. The one I described before that asked me, or that told me I was pretty effed up. And the other psychologist was a young lady I worked with. At the time, she was in her, I would say, late 30s, little girl, very pretty girl. And when I walked into her office, I looked at her and I was like, how are you going to help me? You know, I was like, you look like you're 12 for one. You know, how are you going to help me? How can I relate to you? And that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, this is 2012, so I'm 35, 36 years old, her age. And it just boggled my mind. It literally took, I would say, 6 months, maybe a year before I had the confidence in her to open up. Even though she was a doctorate level psychologist, I wasn't comfortable with sharing the things that I've been through in my life, and I couldn't articulate them either. I didn't know how to explain my emotions or the lack thereof to get them out. Now, she ended up being a great psychologist. She did teach me quite a few things, and she was able to pull things out of me when I dropped my guard down. And that was the big thing. I had such a guard up because I didn't trust her. If I would have known about the peer specialist program at the VA at the time, which I didn't even know it existed, I would have utilized them and her. And I think if that would have taken place, I would have opened up a lot sooner. Because peer specialists at the VA, they're there to be, I don't want to say a mediator, but they help you open up. They help you understand the need to talk to the clinicians. I don't want to say they hold your hand, but you know, if you talk to a clinician and you don't feel comfortable, you could talk to them and they'll mediate for you or they'll advocate for you of that nature.
And that's one of the things that you do now in your work, correct? You're a certified.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Yes,
and,
I am a certified peer specialist, yes.
So when a veteran is meeting with a certified peer specialist, is that typically one-on-one or is there also group discussions? How does that actually work?
So there's both. There's group discussions and you can do one-on-one stuff. And they're just about every capacity you could possibly imagine. At the VA, you know, mental health, physical therapy. I mean, they're everywhere.
I see.
I ended up becoming a recovery coach, which is kind of the predecessor to becoming a certified peer specialist at the VA for about 700 hours. And I did a lot of one-on-one mentoring sessions with guys, and I did group sessions as well. And then on top of that, the clinicians would actually... You would work on different scenarios and situations with clinicians as well. As vets, we're such subject matter experts on military culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that
right.
goes back to what I was talking about when I walked into the office of my psychologist. You know, I understand that you work at the VA and you work with vets every day, but how can you explain to me what it feels like to leave your family or what it feels like to lose a friend in combat, you know, or things of that nature. So it's a hard thing to get over. It's very necessary. Like I said before, I think if guys are in need, they should go get help. And it may take a little bit of time to open up, but it's very important that they do.
Before I turn things over to Richard Hurley, who has some questions about military indoctrination, let me ask you, what kind of technique? So if we have, you know, veterans that are listening tonight that have come back from a deployment that maybe are a little skeptical of the VA, they've heard some stuff that kind of discourage them from going, what are some tips or advice or things that you would offer to them that may kind of help them make that effort and look for that help and then to maybe seek out and specifically ask for, because you mentioned you had not been aware of the peer specialist, but maybe to make sure they ask for that. What kinds of things would you pass on to listeners about that?
Well, first thing I would do if I was at the VA, if I was running through the whole scenario again, I would try to find a certified peer specialist. That way, if you're not ready to open up to your counselor or to your clinician, they'll help you. They'll help you open up, and they'll get you where you're ready to open up a little bit more to them. That's the first thing I would do. Outside of acknowledging the fact that it's time to get some help, you know, that's the first thing. Second thing, you know, when you meet your clinician, this is a personal relationship. This is one thing that both sides need to understand. This is a very personal relationship. There are things that I shared and you will share with your clinician that your wife doesn't know about. You know? So you have to have faith in that individual. If it's not something that, you know, if you meet somebody and you have a few sessions with them and it's just not working, you're not clicking, you don't have that feeling that things are mutual level or whatever the reason may be, you could ask for another clinician. And that's very important. You don't have to stick with the clinician that you're with. A lot of guys, they get fed up, they get aggravated with the person that they're working with, and they just stop what they're doing, and they leave. And then they never go back because that was their experience. And that usually they're jaded from that. You could always change your clinician. And if you don't like the VA, then there's a choice program. You know, I don't know the characteristics exactly how it works, but I do know that you can, the VA will pay for you to go see an outside physician if need be, on certain circumstances. But that's the most important thing, I think. You know, you really got to make sure the person that you're talking to is somebody that you feel you can confide in. Once you're open to doing that, and just don't give up.
Well, that's great advice, and also for veterans to keep in mind that there are peer specialists, those that may be more comfortable with talking with and to help make that transition. That's great advice, Brian, and thank you. Let me turn it over to co-host Richard Hurley, who has some topics he'd like to discuss with you. So, Brian, Richard, here you go. Over to you.
Hey, Brian, how you doing tonight?
Hey, Richard, how you doing tonight?
Tell us about military indoctrination.
All right, so military indoctrination is something that's really talked about. You know, on a clinician side of the house, they look at how were you raised and things of that nature, and they look at what you went through in combat. But I very rarely hear anybody talk about your entire military experience. So military indoctrination, it takes you from a civilian and it turns you into a soldier, whether that soldier is going to be a combat fighting soldier, an administrative soldier, whatever the scenario may be, everybody's trained to a certain standard by military doctrine. You know, the first thing that you have to think about when you think about military obligation, military indoctrination, is the military oath and indoctrination, or the obligation, rather. A military oath is just like being married. You take an oath. You're marrying. You're taking an oath to uphold a contract with somebody, and you can't just walk away from that oath. or that obligation. A lot of people take that oath very seriously. It's something that's ingrained in them, especially if they came from a family tradition of being in the military and they have a sense of duty. Now, first thing that the military does when you get into the base training is you lose your identity. They shave your head. Everybody gets the same clothes. And if you think about today's society, how individualistic we are, that's a big issue for a lot of people. You know, I've seen guys that they walk a certain way and they get in a lot of trouble because they're walking like they're trying to strut their stuff instead of looking professional. You know, I actually have a soldier right now that I always tease him about walking the way he does. And cause I'm like, man, you're not a club. You know, you're in a professional uniform and you're in the public's eye and you have to represent the United States government when you're wearing a uniform. So those are the first two big ones that pretty much changes who you are as a person. Now the third one that we're going to talk about is basically when you join the military and you're going through basic training or even after basic training, you're unequivocally dependent on the military for every facet of your life, whether it be clothing, food, water, sleep. You have to use the restroom. All these things are controlled. You have no say in any of these. And I mean, think about how you take that for granted. You wake up in the morning, look around, you figure out what you're going to wear, or you decide what you're going to have for breakfast and things of that nature, or when you're going to eat. That doesn't exist. Everything that happens in your life is controlled. To add to that, you know, a lot of guys that go in the military, they're atypical, or they didn't grow up with any kind of authority figures in their life, and you know that through calisthenics and through physical training, you know, the military uses pain to remove disobedience. When I was a younger man, I went through infantry school. If you did something wrong, I mean, you're gonna be doing, you know, whether it be sit-ups, push-ups, flutter kicks, calisthenics, whatever the situation may be, for an hour or two sometimes, you know, and complete muscle failure pretty much. You know, and for some people, that's not a big deal. You know, I think for some of us that played sports in high school and stuff like that, if you upset your coach, he'd tell you to go run it. You know, you'd have to run the track or whatnot. This is to a different level. So another thing that's prevalent is peer pressure and peer control. Nobody else wants to get in trouble while you're in basic training or while you're in the military, because it affects everybody. You know, if you're that unlucky guy that's either clumsy or makes a mistake and continues to get in trouble, everybody else is going to pay for it. So that creates a lot of peer pressure and a lot of peer control. You know, I don't know, some of you guys may have seen Full Metal Jacket and stuff like that, where Gomer Pyle got a soap party. You know, stuff like that actually happens. I've seen guys get beat up pretty good in the middle of formations and stuff like that. This is an infantry school now, because they weren't doing what they're supposed to be doing and they're getting everybody else in trouble. And, wow. You know, the follow with that, you know, people are introduced to physical violence. This is something that's, you know, again, for some people, this is perfectly normal. Violence is normal. You know, whether you're from the inner city or the country, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from. You know, if you're used to fighting and stuff like that, and you're hunting and you're used to physical violence, or you come from a violent family or whatnot, then that's, you know, it may not be something that would bother you. But there's a lot of people that don't. They've never been violent in their life. They've never had fights and things of that nature. So the military introduces physical violence in many different ways. You have a physical way, hand-to-hand combat. Then you have, a lot of people, when I went through infantry school, they never seen firearms in their life. You know, and they're issued a firearm, they're issued an M16A4, the first few weeks of infantry school. And the look on their face was priceless. They had no clue what to do with it. So,
wow.
You know, and then they go from there. You know, you're conditioned to believe that military culture is far above and beyond civilian culture. When, even to this day, after 16 years, we're the 1% of the population, and that's harped upon. We're the ones that decided to give up our liberties and our freedom to go fight for our country or to serve our country. And that's really, that's ingrained in us. It's ingrained in us. You know, and there's a lot of, it all depends, you know, like I said, I went to infantry school. I didn't go to other basic trainings. But when I was doing a lot of my trainings, they compared a lot of our tactics with SWAT team tactics and stuff like that. And no matter how good somebody else's stuff was, we were always better, regardless of what was going on. The military is really big on that, really, really big on expounding upon how much better the culture is compared to civilian culture.
Brian, if I could just interject,
yes, of
something
course.
Here. Does it strike you, as it does me, that in the civilian world, that most civilians are completely clueless as to that mindset in the military? That the civilian culture, many people in the civilian world, who particularly if they've never been in the military or don't know anyone in the military, they really look down on the military. I realize I might be overly generalizing, but I think it's true for a lot of people. And they have no clue that, in fact, in the military is looking down on them as being inferior in any number of ways. Do you have that same impression?
You know, I do. I do. I've experienced it myself. For what I've been talked down to by professors, in college and then by old employers, because I was in the military, they treated me different. You know, to give you one example, though, of why the military teaches you it's far above civilian culture. For instance, in the Army, everybody has the same last name. Your last name is Army. Everybody wears the same uniform. There's no individualism.
Right.
It doesn't matter what race you are. It doesn't matter what religion you are. None of those things exist. We all went through the same hell, and we all came out and shined. You know, and I can't say that that's a bad thing. You know, that there's organizations out there that can completely and totally separate themselves from race, from discrimination. Now, am I going to say that doesn't happen? Of course it happens. But they try to ingrain it in us that the person next to you is wearing the same outfit you're wearing. They bleed green, and they have the same last name as you. And that's where really that comes from. They're trying to get rid of all the stuff that we learn as civilians. Because, you know, some people do grow up with bigotry and things of that nature.
Right.
I hope that answered. That may have been the long way to answer that.
No, I appreciate that, yes. So, you were telling us more about some of the other aspects of indoctrination, how people are molded into serving, into being in the military. What are some of the other ones?
You know, so with everything I just went over, you know, that enlarges people's egos. You know, if you're a very quiet, shy person when you went into the military and into basic training or whatnot, you're likely not going to be quiet and shy after basic training, because they're going to pull it out of you. You know, drill sergeants see that. They see the quiet kid. You know, and they want you to break out of your shell. And they do enlarge a lot of egos. Narcissists thrive in the military. They thrive, especially when they start gaining rank and things of that nature. They could shoot good if they're good at PT. They're pretty intelligent. They're going to outrank and outshine everybody. You know, and then we're, regardless of any situation, no matter what it is, we're conditioned to follow orders. Now, unlawful orders are harped on as well. I should make that difference real quick. We're not conditioned to follow unlawful orders. They're very particular when they're training us what a lawful order is and what is not a lawful order. But you'll do some dumb stuff in the military. I mean, you know, you've seen guys wash rocks and vacuum parking lots with vacuum cleaners or mop parking lots while it's raining. Ridiculous things, but you have to follow the order because it's an order. And I think those mind games happen so they remind you who they are and what the authority is. Right. Now, I don't know how it is today. I went in back in 01. I'm sorry, 02. But I didn't have a name until probably halfway through infantry school. I was roster 109, and I was called 109. After that, after probably about halfway through infantry school, I was private. And it wasn't until about probably the last 2 weeks of infantry school they actually called me by my last name. I had to earn that. That wasn't something that they just give you. You know, and finally, ultimately, out of everything that we just discussed, self-sacrifice is huge. I don't know if there's any Marines listening. You know, everything you do is for the military. Whether it's you jump on a grenade or, you know, you work 24 hours in a row or leave your family, everything's about self-sacrifice. Selfless service, as they call it.
Right.
So, yep. You know, if you think about what we just discussed, that pretty much changes somebody's personality in every way. You know, when you complete basic training in infantry school, wherever you go, you're no longer the same individual that you were before. And in a lot of respects, that's a good thing. You could think objectively. There's no bigotry. You carry yourself with pride. A little bit more articulate because you have to talk clearly. You know, there's a lot of positive things for basic training and going in the military. You learn how to be resilient and push through adversity and adapt to just about any situation you can think of. And it teaches you that your mind's a lot stronger than what you think it is. Your mind will actually give up before your body gives up. A lot of people don't realize that.
Wow.
So,
Richard, go ahead, Richard.
No, that's all right. I'm just...
Well, okay. Well, thanks, Brian. What I wanted to follow up with would be that's a great overview of the indoctrination process. I guess the next logical point would be, what are the ramifications? What effect does that have both short-term and long-term? And then from that, you know, what do you see, post-service? How does that translate into things? So what are some of the ramifications of that indoctrination?
So the ramifications of indoctrination are a lot different than going through the indoctrination process itself. And this is kind of the what I call a little bit more of the dark side of the military culture and the military hierarchy. So the ramification of indoctrination, you lose independent thought. Until you gain a certain rank, you really don't think for yourself. You're pretty much told to shut up and just do what you're told. And if you have a good idea, whether it's legitimate or not, it doesn't exist because nobody likes a good idea theory, as we call it in the military. Another thing that we're taught very early on is you have to internalize your emotions and physical pain. You can't show emotion when you're conducting operations or you're in the public's eye. Or if you're getting yelled at, you just, you know, you can't break down and cry or have an emotional outburst. And you have to contain yourself. And that you're really taught and trained to internalize your emotions and really bury them deep. You know, and that, unfortunately, what that leads to is externalizing negative emotions. So all those emotions that you bury deep, they got to come out somehow. And unfortunately, a lot of times they come out on young soldiers' families or on older soldiers' families. You can't have that emotional release or outburst at home. So unfortunately, it comes out after work, or it comes out, you know, at the bar when somebody's had a few too many drinks. You know, the easiest way for me to explain this from my own personal experience, and when I was in Afghanistan, I told you guys I had to stuff all my emotions because of everything I was going through. And I was literally praying for the day that I could unleash them on somebody. If that makes any sense to you guys. I was really praying for I had so much pent-up anger and so much emotion that I was just waiting to unleash them on somebody.
Brian, let me ask you this. In hindsight,
yes, sir.
If you were advising the military, and not just advise the military on how to do basic training, but throughout a soldier's entire time of service, what advice would you give the military about what you were just talking about, which is the you know, internalizing these emotional and physical, the pain, but then also the fact that you described it, these bottle up emotions, they're going to come out at some point. They're going to exhibit themselves either through destructive behavior, violence, or whatever. What, in hindsight, what should the military be doing differently? And I could think of a lot of things, but what's your thoughts? What are your thoughts on what can be done?
You know, things are changing a little bit. I'm not on active duty, so I can't tell you how things ran on a military base, but I can tell you access to mental health providers, or maybe not mental health providers is the right word, but maybe peer counselors or mentors, I think that would be so important. That a young soldier can go talk to, or an NCO that, you know, that needs to vent outside of his chain of command without right. recourse. You know, and you know, in a perfect world, it'd be great if everybody had to go through a debriefing. A weekly debriefing or something like that, or you know, whatever the situation may be. You know, because I could tell you as a young soldier, the few times that I did have like a mental health debriefing, you lie, you run through it, you don't take it serious. Because there's always in the back of your mind that there's going to be a stigma attached to it. That if somebody found out about it, you'd be considered weak. Or it could potentially have an effect on your career. So I think, you know, more access to mentors and mental health providers would probably be the key. You know, because like anything else, as adults, you know, there's, you know, sometimes you got to go see a therapist because you can't confide in your family, or they're the actual people that are causing issues. So I think that would be important. I think that would be important. You know, the indoctrination is there for a process. It takes a civilian and turns them into a soldier. So some of these things are a necessity. You know, like
then I guess the process.
There are some pretty ramifications. There are some ramifications that goes along with it.
What are some of the things you see maybe in terms of, you know, substance abuse, anxiety, anger, and maybe other ramifications that people need to recognize as being related and then seek help? What are some of those ramifications?
Well, you know, black and white thought, that's a huge one. It's there's no gray area. I'm right, you're wrong, period. Mm-hmm. And that causes all kinds of issues, especially social issues and personal relationship type issues with a spouse or a child. You know, as far as alcohol goes, yeah, you know, alcohol in the military goes hand in hand, just like college and alcohol go hand in hand as part of the culture. You know, we're you're taught to play hard and you're taught to fight hard, and play harder than you fight. You know, in my time during the military, we've done a lot of drinking in my time in service, and you know, it's definitely part of the culture. Definitely part of the culture. There's some pretty severe ramifications that go along with that. You know, those emotions that we discussed. Imagine a young soldier that may have deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq has been trained to internalize all of his emotions, comes home and he starts drinking.
Right.
You know, a whole deployment just came out in one night.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, I could harp on alcohol for hours, but, you know, getting back into things, you know, the ramifications of indoctrination, it really causes a lot of issues, anxiety, depression, alcoholism, anger. Like I said, you don't have independent thought. Down the road, when you do gain some rank, or if you're high speed, you know, if you come in, you're college educated, and you prove yourself, and you're outdoing everybody else, and hopefully you're not peered out, you know, then you might rise above some of the peer pressure and the passive aggression type stuff that goes on. But, you know, entering the military, these are the things that you kind of go through. You know, you get people that internalize your position. You know, you get somebody that's young and in a leadership position. All of a sudden, they're in charge for the first time probably in their lives. And that could be a power trip. And like I said, we're indoctrinated to follow any order that we're given. Now, I can remember as a young soldier, I was asked to clean weapons of corporals and stuff like that. And I was like, you're out of your mind. You're a corporal. I did it because he told me to do it. But there's people that will abuse that power. And that's anywhere, not just the military.
Right. I would add, too, and this goes back to something you started with when you were talking about taking the oath and the obligation, is a huge difference between the military world and the civilian world is that you just can't walk off your job. You can go to prison for AWOL, for desertion, for showing disrespect to a superior. I mean, everything is criminalized with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which takes things, the consequences, to a level that civilians really, they don't understand at all until they've been in that situation, realize the impact of it. That's my opinion. But I think that's also part of the indoctrination.
100%. And, you know, and I was actually going to bring that up. I just noticed that we're running a little low on time. But,
yeah.
You know, when I first started out here, it's like being married. You know, you could either have a really, really good relationship that's very strong. You know, you work things out and things of that nature, or you could have a nightmare. You know, and
right.
You know, with
right.
a divorce, you know, with a bad marriage, you could walk away and get divorced. You know, the right. military, when you know, unless you get a dishonorable discharge or a general discharge, and you fight your way out, and then that's going to affect your life in the long run.
Right.
You're stuck.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you're stuck. It doesn't matter if you like it or don't like it, and they let you know. They will let you know you're stuck.
Right.
You know.
Right.
If
I could just add too that another thing I think that most civilians don't appreciate is really the notion that you really have no control over your life. That you have no control when the country goes to war. You have no. And I think back to when I was on active duty, the difference between, you know, August 1st of 1990. And August 2nd, 1990. August 2nd was the day that Iraq invaded Kuwait, setting in motion all that. It's just like the difference between September 10th, 2001, and September 11th, 2001. The world can change in an instant, and you could find yourself a soldier a week later being deployed to a part of the world that you'd never even really thought of, you know, and your life is on the line. It's just a huge, huge thing. And when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, it's a shock. It can be a shock to the system. But, Brian, as we're wrapping up this segment of the show, if perhaps you could add two things. First, maybe some tips from how you took your life back, and then second, tell our listeners again your websites where they can go for more information.
Of course. So the most important thing that I realized when I came home from Afghanistan was that Afghanistan affected me. And I knew that I needed to talk to somebody that could relate to what I was going through and be able to help me identify what I was going through. I had to be honest with myself, and I had to be honest with the person that I was talking to. A lot of us, we either try not to sound like we've been through a lot, so it kind of masks what's really going on. So you really got to be honest. I had to set my own realistic goals. You know, I knew I wasn't going to get better overnight. I was hoping it was going to be within a year or so. I've been doing this since 2012, and I'm still working at it. I still slip every now and then and lose my temper, or I don't want to leave the house because of unfortunate things that happen in society. I had to allow my therapist to challenge my thoughts, and this is one of the things that I think is very important. Once you gain a rapport with a therapist, let them challenge your thoughts and your behaviors. We're not always right. We're not always in control. That black and white thought that I was talking about, we need to let that go a little bit and relinquish a little bit of control so people can actually help us understand that, you know, our actions and our behaviors are causing other people pain, whether it be physical pain or emotional pain. We need to hear that. We need to allow ourselves to hear that.
Wow. That's great advice, Brian. I'm sorry.
And the other thing I did a lot of research, guys, and I'll leave it at that. I did a lot of research. I never trust the news about, you know, did we go overseas for this reason or that reason? Yeah, people got to turn that stuff off because it's going to drive you crazy.
Yep.
So empirical research is key.
That's been great. So, now, your main website is PTSDRecoveryProgram.com, and I know you have just a tremendous amount of great resources because I've checked it out and looked at the links, and I really encourage listeners to check that out as well. Brian, any closing thoughts or comments you want to make, perhaps about to highlight your website there or also your GoFundMe program?
You know, I'll be really quick because I know you guys got to get out of here. You know, it's made for the guy that's sitting in front of the computer at 1 o'clock in the morning that needs answers or that wants to start exploring what it may look like if he started thinking about receiving any kind of psychiatric care or mental health care or looking for resources in his area. Right. The GoFundMe account that I have set up, it's my 5-year plan. I'd like to have a clinic one day for veterans and their families. That's pretty much peer support driven. We would have clinicians, but it'd be mostly military members talking to military members that are very relatable.
Well, very good, Brian, and we certainly wish you all the best. We thank you so much for being on our show, particularly 2 Mondays in a row. We appreciate all the time and all the dedication you have, and thank you for your service as well. We hope perhaps from time to time you'll come back on our show and share more of your insights and keep us posted on things. And thank you so much for being on our show. Hope you have a good rest of the week.
Well, thank you so much for the time again, Richard. David, thank you.
Thanks,
again.
Brian.
Thank you,
Brian,
for the help that you work with the veterans. Thank you so much.
Thank
have a good
you.
Night.
Okay. Good night. Well, Richard, that was great. I know we've got about 5 minutes left. We can talk. Did you want to talk about the Dr. Shulkin event? You want to talk about some other news first?
Well, we can. The latest thing on Dr. Shulkin was February 14, 2018. The VA IG released a report about an investigation into Veterans Secretary David Shulkin's official trip to Europe in July of 2017. The findings led to the resignation this past week of VA Chief of Staff Savika Wright Simpson. Ms. Wright Simpson had, according to the VA IG report, made false representations to a VA ethics official and altered an official record, resulting in VA improperly paying for the VA secretary's wife to travel at U.S. government expense. It is important to note that there is no evidence that Secretary Shulkin was aware in advance of those alleged false representations. And furthermore, since that time, those funds have since been reimbursed by Secretary Shulkin, even though he disputes the IG's conclusions. The IG also concluded that Secretary Shulkin improperly accepted Wimbledon tickets. According to the IG report, Secretary Shulkin and his wife, Dr. Merrill Berry, who is a dermatologist in private practice, attended the ladies' final tennis match at Wimbledon on July 15, 2017, which was the Saturday following the Copenhagen trip and 4 days before the London summit meetings began. Secretary Shulkin told OIG investigators that he received tickets for the event from Ms. Victoria Gosling, whom he described as his wife's friend. According to publicly available information, Ms. Gosling is a UK resident and head of social impact at Auden, a for-profit enterprise, a military director at Sage Foundation, the philanthropic affiliate of UK software company Sage Group PLC, and a military counselor for the Lawn Tennis Association, which is the national governing body for tennis in Great Britain, including Wimbledon. Ms. Gosling also served as CEO of the 2016 Invictus Games and held in Orlando, Florida. Ms. Gosling not only provided the Wimbledon tickets, but she also hosted Secretary Shulkin, Dr. Berry, and their adult son for lunch before the match at the private members' dining room at Wimbledon. The IG also found that Secretary Shulkin directed the misuse of a subordinate's official time. The OIG also determined that the Europe trip resulted in a misuse of VA resources. While the delegation spent 9 full days in Europe, there were only 3.5 days of meetings in addition to a reception the evening before the start of the London summit. Prior to the trip, Secretary Shulkin directed VA program specialist to work with Dr. Berry to plan personal activities for the secretary and Dr. Berry during the trip. Email supports the conclusion that Mr. Goff made extensive use of official time for planning leisure activities. Mr. Goff effectively acted as a personal travel concierge to the secretary and Dr. Berry. The IG also found that there was inadequate documentation to assess the accuracy and appropriateness of the cost of the trip, and also that the VA issued a misleading statement to the Washington Post about the trip and did not correct the statement despite knowing that it was not entirely accurate. Of course, there are usually two sides to most issues, and that's no exception here. Secretary Shulkin hired a private law firm to represent his side of the matter, and that law firm has submitted a rebuttal to the report, disputing the completeness and accuracy of the facts described by the report, as well as contesting the IG's conclusions. The IG report also includes a rebuttal signed by Secretary Shulkin and dated last Monday, February 12, 2018, which provides as follows. And of course,
but if I could hit a couple of high points from Dr. Shulkin's rebuttal, because you can, first of all, our listeners, if they want to access the IG report, it's available through the VA IG office's website, and it includes Secretary Shulkin's law firm's rebuttal, which is quite detailed, very extensive, and then a two-page letter from February 12th from Dr. Shulkin himself. And he's very strong and adamant in disputing what he believes are attacks on his character, and he disputes the accuracy of the report in many respects. And it's very clear he takes issue also with the fact that the IG report purports to kind of depict his wife in the fashion which they have. And in any event, the point is that it's Dr. Shulkin does dispute the report, although it's my understanding he has reimbursed government for his wife's travel. Just as an aside, it appears in looking at the media that Congress doesn't appear to be holding this matter against Secretary Shulkin. He has very many supporters on Capitol Hill, as well as most of the major veteran groups support him strongly. But he also has some opponents within the Trump administration that, you know, in the Washington, D.C. world, the daggers are out. Don't know how this is going to unfold, but it is an important issue. Why? Not because of the, you know, the particular aspects or facts, but because we're talking about the Secretary of the VA, particularly one who has been very visible in trying to lead some reform measures.
David, if I can add something.
Sure.
You know, I dealt, you know, I was a former ethics chair in New Jersey, and I always had one rule whenever I dealt with ethics issues. I'm not saying this is an ethics issue, but it's the analogy is very similar. And that is, if you're going to do something that's a little squeezy in your stomach, you know you shouldn't be doing it. So anytime, it's not just Shulkin, but we've had this now going on with the Trump administration where there just seems to be this entitlement when they get on these trips, and for whatever reason, they do a brush and they get close to that line. Some of them cross the line. The bottom line is you shouldn't even get close to the line.
True.
Just don't do it, period. End of story.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Be, you know, stick to your government job. And if you just go over there and fly home and don't even go to Wimbledon, then don't go. Just do your job. Don't get close to that line. Then we won't have these discussions.
Right. Yeah, well, that's good advice. And it's unfortunate because this matter is a distraction that is taking a lot of resources and time away from veteran issues, which is what this show is about, and certainly the mission of the VA. So we were about out of time tonight, so we'll have to wrap up real quick. I'd like to thank all our listeners for listening. Thank our show producer, Mr. Doug Newsom. We invite our listeners to tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope you have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.